Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. My voice may sound a little scratchy, but I assure you, I am much, much better than I was yesterday. I have a very common affliction. It's called strep throat. And I just wanted to first talk about the wonder drug penicillin. It is a glorious drug. I even read up some on the history of penicillin. I knew about Alexander Fleming and the fact that some mold from his sandwich appears to have saved human history, but I hadn't realized that some three people before him had discovered the drug. It is a magical drug, particularly when you think that the Streptococcus virus can actually kill you. In fact, it normally would. And that I can just get rid of this disease by popping a few pills. And I've only had four since yesterday, but boy, do I feel better. So I'm not well yet. Hang in with me. But I was thinking, though, as I was taking my first penicillin pill and, you know, kind of urging it on, go, drugs, go, get that bacteria. I was thinking about the children of those that practice Christian Science. I mean, what do they do? When their kid gets strep throat, as most kids do, I mean, it's actually more common in school because you're just associating with all the different people. Do they let their kids die? I mean, I was really thinking about this, and I don't really know the answer. Here is an easily cured ailment that, if going untreated, will kill you. And it's very common. I mean, I get strep throat, I don't know, once every 2-3 years. Some people may get it more often, some less. What do they do? What do they do? I'll tell you this much. If parents refused to give their kids penicillin to cure strep throat, I would have zero hesitation, zero, none, zilch, about forcibly taking that child. And if necessary, heck, I'd even forcibly inject an unwilling child. Now, you know, an adult, I understand. I agree with, you know, free liberty, the extent, in fact, like the Oregon suicide bill. I understand, you know, if you're 20, you're 25, you're 30, you want to commit suicide, I would try to stop you too. But there I might give you a little more willingness to reject a drug. But a child of Christian Science parents, a child who really thinks that praying is going to heal him or her, no way. Strap the kid down, inject the penicillin in him or her. No sympathy whatsoever. I think the child would thank me later. I mean, how could he or she not? I mean, I was just thinking about this as I was, you know, of course, feverish, and rolling around in my bed, unable to sleep under the influence of this awful bacteria. This is when the idea came to my mind last night, somewhere between 2 and 3 a.m. when I woke up 6 or 7 times. At least last night was easier than the night before because I knew that penicillin was working, and lo and behold, I do feel much better. But I was thinking about that poor child, and then I was thinking, what happens if their parents pray over him and pray over him or pray over her or pray over her? And, of course, she gets worse and worse. 4 days pass, 5 days pass, she gets worse and worse. You can't cure strep throat just by resting and drinking liquid. You know, that's how you treat a cold, not a bacterial infection. You can't get better just by wishing it away. I'm sorry. No disrespect to religion. No disrespect to God. You can't get rid of it by praying. So what happens when the child gets worse and worse and worse? And then, this is all my hypothetical scenario. I have no idea if it's ever happened. Maybe one of you listeners who are far more informed and intelligent than I on a number of topics Maybe one of y'all can call in and let me know if you know of a real case. But in my hypothetical imagination, I imagine that the Christian Science parents, those that believe that God can cure all religions, excuse me, I don't know if that was a Freudian slip, that God can cure all diseases without the need of doctors or medication. You know, I imagine this child refusing, because that's what she's taught to believe, and getting worse and worse and more sick, then being forcibly strapped down by some government agent who I'm sure is called evil by all in the Christian Science community. I guess they want to use snakes or laying on hands. So the evil government would come in, strap the child down if the child refuses, and what else are you going to do? Hold the child down, give the child a choice, right? Pill or injection. Most kids would choose the pill. I don't know what you do if they hold their mouth shut. But whether by forcing a pill in her mouth or giving her an injection and seeming like an awful, awful bully, after all, getting an injection is much easier when you want it and expect it than when you don't. So is taking a pill. But then, penicillin, you got to take that 4 times a day. I mean, this takes a lot of work and a lot of intervention. I guess you'd have to remove the child from the parents. But then she would get better. He would get better. The child would get better. Don't you think that might change her faith? And then you know you'd have a court decision. You know the parents would appeal all the way up to the Supreme Court. They're attacking our religion. They're attacking our religion. Well, let me make something perfectly clear. I strongly believe in free exercise of religion. In fact, I'm the guy who challenged Antonin Scalia, my favorite justice, to pick on, because he's the biggest hypocrite. Hey, at least Thomas isn't a hypocrite. Thomas, you know, is hateful and kind of admits it. Scalia pretends he's not. Pretends he's a strict instructionist. But I argued with Scalia for some free exercise of religion. I argued in the peyote case that, you know, Native Americans that have been here thousands of years before white people came to these shores and executed 90% of them, that they should be allowed to practice their religion, even if it involves a hallucinogenic drug. They're not hurting anybody else. I believe in religious accommodation. I think that if a Jewish physician is in the army, he should be allowed to wear a kippah, a yarmulke on his head. It's part of his religion. It doesn't harm anyone. If a Muslim woman wants to wear a scarf around her head, I mean, I think you can go too far. If you only show her eyes, you know, that burqa, I'm not so sure about. You have to be able to identify someone. But a scarf around their head or a Christian wants to wear a cross, I think that kind of accommodation should be allowed. You know, kosher food. I understand that. I respect that. But accommodation of religion ends when death begins. I actually think that's a pretty easy principle to defend. Accommodating religion ends when death begins. Right? There may be religions, in fact, I'm sure there are, ancient religions, thousands of years old, that believe that in order to appease the gods, to get rain, you throw a virgin into a pit. And the virgin may even want to go. But we can prevent that in America. In fact, the argument I made to Justice Scalia was that it's a balancing test, that you weigh the religion and you along with the neutral principle you're trying to protect. And if it's death versus religion, you know, life beats religion. If it's religion versus some minor bureaucratic principle that doesn't harm, you know, religion wins. If you're not harming anyone, in fact, in general, if you're not harming anyone, absolute free exercise of religion, as long as you're not harming anybody else. Absolutely. In your own private homes, in your private schools, not if you're in a public place, well, you're harming other people who don't share your religion. But it depends. I mean, there's religion where you say, I'm a Christian, and you wear a cross. That doesn't bother me. And there's a religion where you speak out in public and say, now everyone come pray with me to Jesus. Well, that's different. That's a public harming others. So I think it's a weighing test. Scalia argued at the time with me that, no, it's neutral principles. Neutral principles always trump religion. And those of you that know this story know that I then asked Scalia in front of a large audience if the neutral principle of civil rights, specifically discrimination against women, wouldn't that then trump the practice of the Catholic Church? If a state passed a statute requiring all men and women to be treated equally under the law, wouldn't that mean that the Catholic Church would have to hire women priests? Scalia backed down then on his assessment that neutral principles always trump religion, and after proved to be a hypocrite, walked away. But all this came to my mind in my literally feverish imagination. Hey, that's rare that I can say that. I was literally feverish last night, 101. Proud to say it. You know, that's what guys do, right? I had 101. Yeah, well, I had 102. I was in more pain than you. I guess that's something that guys do. We brag about how much pain we're in as if it's a badge of honor. Okay, so 101. Ha ha, beat that. No, don't. Please don't. It doesn't feel good. But as I'm lying in a disgusting pool of my own sweat, Tylenol, by the way, is terrific for, this is not a doctor's health show, but just if you ever get a fever, please take Tylenol. It's what hospitals use, and it certainly saved me last night. But in my feverish sweat, I was thinking about a poor kid. Now, I will fervently defend the right of crazy religious people to teach their crazy religious doctrines to their children. It's their right. It's the Constitution. It's the First Amendment. They have a right to do it, y'all, but not when it causes death or great harm or even kind of minor harm. Not when it causes harm. No, don't call me psychological harm because I know that it probably does. I can't stop that one. But death is an easy line to draw. So, yes, I would strap down the child that is the child of Christian Scientists that has streptococcus, and I would force feed that boy or girl the wonder drug of penicillin. And I was just reading on penicillin and how it saved a ton of troops' lives in the end of World War II. It really wasn't ready and mass-produced until 1944. And I just wonder how people survived. How did they survive before 1944? I don't know. All praise penicillin. I was also thinking, when's the last time have we had a major drug cure a major disease? Polio comes to mind, but nothing since then. And I think it's because the pharmaceutical companies make a lot more money off Viagra and other drugs like that. If they cure a disease, how are they going to treat you with drugs? A lot cheaper, a lot better, a lot more profitable for pharmaceutical companies to treat AIDS than to cure it, right? Excuse me, I'm going into conspiracy land. I will back out of it and talk to Susan, our news ninja, on the line. Susan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Being in Oregon, I not only have an actual case for you, but I'd like to clear up a misconception about our assisted suicide bill.
Please do, and I fully admit, at the top of the hour, I am not an expert in Oregon law or in your assisted suicide bill, so please correct my ignorance.
Okay, the assisted suicide statute is hitched about with a great many preconditions before you could use it, one of which, the main one of which, is you have to be terminally ill. You can't just walk in and say, hey, I'm depressed, I'm going to check out.
That's an important distinction. Very important.
Yeah, you have a panel of psychiatrists who sit on you and decide if you're mentally competent.
Those are both good things. And in general, I want to try to prevent people from committing suicide. I do understand it, particularly in the case of the terminally ill. You know, I know many people who feel that if they get in the same situation Terry Schiavo is, when they're brain dead, when literally there's nothing left going on up there, there's an empty body with, I don't know whether you believe in a soul or not, but the, let's just say the person has left the building, right? The actual thing that makes us, has left the body living. I mean, I don't know what the difference is between Terry Schiavo and a corpse. I mean, think about it. Neither of them can think. Neither of them can feel. Neither of them can talk. They have no reflection. They can't. They have no senses. None of the five senses work. What is the difference between Terry Schiavo and a corpse? I don't know. I'll tell you this. If someone says, keep me alive by any means possible, that's their right. They can choose that. But people also have the right to decide, you know what, I don't want to waste all this money, it's time to pull the plug. Now, if there were a chance of her coming back to life, a realistic chance, you know, not a one in a trillion if lightning strikes chance, you know, then I'd feel differently. But at the end of the day, no, I think Oregon statute, again, as long as you're very careful, and it makes some sense.
Well,
I apologize. I did not mean to misstate your... I wasn't even planning to talk about Oregon. I just went on a riff about penicillin and did not mean to take your state in vain.
I do have an actual case of a religious splinter group who had a child, a young child. I think she was a toddler. And she got sick. And they wanted to pray her back to health.
How old was she?
It didn't work. Less than
9, 10, something like that, or younger?
No, less than 2.
Oh, a baby.
Under
it was
2.
A baby.
Yeah, a baby.
Oh, my God. That's even worse. I mean, a 16-year-old, you could think maybe can make some decisions. A baby, that's terrible.
It didn't work. It didn't work.
The baby died. I would put those parents in jail for murder.
That's exactly what the state of Oregon is trying to do.
Are they trying them? I would put them in jail. I mean, it wouldn't be first-degree murder. It would be like voluntary manslaughter, something like that.
Yeah, they've been charged.
When's the trial?
That I don't know just yet.
But it's coming up soon, right?
Well,
I mean, the next few months or so?
No, it's going to be the better part of a year before the trial comes up.
Oh, okay.
You
interesting case. I'll be very interested to hear the result. I would think they could do it. The real question is not whether the state could prove the case. The question is whether a jury would convict. Because you might get one fundy holding out for a hung jury.
Yeah. The big problem was up until a couple of years ago, they would not have been able to charge them because there was a specific exemption in Oregon law. But they had so many children dying because of these crazy people.
There was an exemption that allowed you to refuse necessary medical care at Oregon law because of your religion? Really?
Exactly. Yes.
Good for repealing that. When did you repeal it in Oregon?
No more.
When did you repeal that in Oregon?
It's been in the last couple of years.
Just 2 years ago?
Yes.
You mean before 2 years ago, parents could let their kids die and have no consequences? That's amazing. I don't think of Oregon as that conservative.
Well, the thing is, Oregon is a really strange state. It's almost schizophrenic.
It's Portland and the rest, right?
It's basically the West Coast, which is what everybody thinks of Oregon as liberal, very blue, very progressive, and then the whole rest of the state, which is free for land.
But does anybody live in the rest of the state? I mean, it's pretty sparse, isn't it?
We have a running joke it's kind of a toss-up which state it originated in, Washington or Oregon, that the people in the western section keep sending over unmanned probe to the eastern side of the mountains to see if there's life back there. We can't find anything.
I think you should just let Idaho annex them both, just the eastern parts of Washington and Oregon. There's no hope for Idaho anyway, so just give it up to Idaho. They're not going to have two really good states.
There may be hope yet for Idaho. Because Idaho may actually elect their first Democratic congressman in decades this year.
Wow.
Yeah, I about that.
Of course, an Idaho Democrat, I'm sure, is far to the right of a New York Republican. Well, I couldn't say a Massachusetts Republican because there are none in Congress. So I say a New York Republican.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But just the fact that they're willing to use label Democrat is a shock.
Well, you know, Idaho, that's black helicopter land, right? I mean, that's Curt Lane. That's the where the Nazis found their home.
Don't
get me wrong, and I don't want to attack all the Idahoans. There are plenty of good Idahoans. I know, in fact, I once said something like this, and someone from Coeur d'Alene was very upset, and she called me or she wrote me, I forget which, and she said, now, wait a minute, don't tar all of us because of those horrible neo-Nazis. And so I want to be fair and be clear that many Idahoans do hate that. But at the end of the day, I think there's a reason why they chose that area of the country because, you know, I don't think they would have chosen, Selma, Alabama. I don't think they would have chosen Manhattan, you know. There must be some fellow travelers up there. Not all, but there must be some.
Yeah, there's not many, but there are some people who actually think, just get that line here. And that's why it's so amazing. That's what convinced me that there is a large movement in the works because 30,000 people showed up one afternoon to see Barack Obama in Boise.
300,000?
No, 30,000.
30,000. Okay, it's still a large number, but 300,000 was going to stun me. 30,000 is still a large number.
I didn't think there were 30,000 Democrats in the entire state.
Well, you know, and Democrats tend to give up on Idaho because, if you look at the reddest state in the United States, it's either Idaho or Utah. I don't know which, but they regularly give,
They're closely linked 60. By...
lots of Mormons and fundies and freepers. But still, I think Democrats have got to go there for, like you said, we can win congressional seats, we can win state races. But when I think of Idaho, I have to admit, and I'm sorry to all you decent Idahoans out there, both of you. No, I'm sorry, that's not nice. All of you. But I think of a Congresswoman, Helen Chenoweth, who was in Congress when I was there. And she was completely of the black helicopter school. She honestly believed that, the government was flying black helicopters over people and spying on them. And the irony is that even though she was a right-wing wacko, a lot of what she said actually came true. The government is spying on us. Now, I don't know about the black helicopters. I can't vouch for that. But it turns out the government is spying on hundreds of millions of us. So even though she was a crazy wacko, and she was, and she said all kinds of awful things, it's just ironic to me that at the far ends we can actually agree many in the West very much care about their civil liberties. And that's one of the things they actually share with Democrats. So we actually have some things in common with some of those people that in other contexts I would call wacko.
Yeah, and before people start screaming, well, what does she know about Idaho? I used to live there, just outside
of
a little town called Meridian.
Where is that?
Boise, by the... it's just outside of Boise.
It's a suburb of Boise. Well, I assume that Boise, like all relatively large cities, would be more democratic than the rest of the state.
Well, yeah.
Than the rest of the state. I assume it's like moderate Republican versus right-wing wacko Republican.
Right. Boise is the only state capital, and I've been in quite a few, who, honest to God, when I was there, you could go up in right next to the Capitol building and see signs on the sidewalk that said, quote, no horses on the sidewalk.
Well, I mean, I respect that. That's part of the charm of the Old West. I don't have a problem with that.
It's just that whole attitude. That's the attitude they have. And it's, They go their way, and they will take the hindmost.
So, Susan, what were you doing in Idaho? If you don't mind my asking. You don't have to answer that question. You can certainly object.
My husband and I moved over there because he had a job.
Okay. Well, that's sort of what
miserable.
I expected.
I was raised in Seattle, so I'm not used to all that dry.
Yeah, yeah. And all that conservatism.
Oh, yeah.
So were you seen as a total fish out of water that people laugh at you like, what? You don't support Cheney, right or wrong? Are you crazy? I mean, did people, I don't know if Bush and Cheney were in power then, were they?
No, they weren't in power. How long ago was this? I left Idaho in 89.
So you were there mostly when Reagan was president, and you must have been the only people in Idaho that didn't like President Reagan.
You bet.
So did people treat you here comes the crazy liberal? Did they know your views? Did you keep them quiet?
Well, out of sheer self-preservation, I bit my tongue a lot.
Really?
Yeah, my husband's family are right-wing religious nuts. And in order to just get along, to avoid starting a family war... I just bit my tongue a lot.
Okay. I hear you. I hear you. Matt in the chat room has accused me of calling city folk better than country folk. Did I do that? Tell me the truth. Did I do that? If I did, I mean, I thought I was picking on conservative rubes, not necessarily country rubes, but I got to watch my own prejudices. I was thinking about prejudices the other day. And by the way, I want to thank you for your call. So is there anything else you want to talk about?
Nope. Just wanted to bring that up, though.
I appreciate you doing that.
I'll tell you about that case.
Oh, I definitely want you to follow up on that case. I'm definitely very interested. But thanks for calling, Susan. I was thinking, Matt's point about prejudice, I was thinking about my own prejudices the other day and wondering if I have a, one of those citified elitist prejudices. I don't know. I mean, like Barack Obama, I went to the fancy schmancy Ivy League law school, right? And, you know, someone was attacking Obama the other day because he will sometimes eat arugula. And apparently, if you're not an East Coast liberal elitist, you're not supposed to know what arugula lettuce is. And I do, so I don't know. I don't like cafe latte. I don't go to Starbucks. Do I get any points for that? But I was thinking about the comment that's going to be used throughout the election. And if there's a Republicans, I'd hesitate to say it, but they already know it. They already know it. The bitter, infamous bitter comment that frankly no one would have found out about if some blogger hadn't attended and gotten a very bad recording that they later told us what it was, and Obama hadn't fessed up to it, which was honest, but politically damaging. But the one where he said that people cling to their guns and to their religion, it was a badly phrased comment, and I think it was a gaffe in the sense that a gaffe means when a politician tells the truth about what he's really thinking. And I do think there are people who have religion and are perfectly normal and good people and use it to help people and use it to their advantage. I think there are people who have guns, hunters, that use it for sport. And while I would have a hard time shooting a living creature, I understand that people do, and heck, I eat meat, so I'd be a hypocrite if I were to tell a hunter to put down his gun when pointed at a cow or an animal that I eat. So I respect the right of people who have guns and have religion, but I kind of understand where Obama was coming from. But I was thinking about Obama's prejudices when I heard Phil Graham's comment. Because Phil Graham committed the classic Republican gaffe. They don't say it out loud. But behind closed doors, they absolutely think we are a nation of whiners. And they say it, and they say it to their friends, and they say it in private gatherings all the time, and Phil Graham's only mistake was saying it in public. Because to Republicans, you gotta know your place. It's the same thing they told the slaves. Know your place. Know your standing in life. Know where you stand. Don't get all uppity. Don't get all high and mighty. Know your place. And if you're born poor, well, sorry, you're poor. Deal with it. A real man doesn't complain. And if you're born rich, enjoy it. You have no obligation to help others. That's socialism. That's communism. That's Soviet-style behavior. If your grandfather made a fortune in the hotel business, well, you should be able to get hundreds of billions of dollars tax-free. And then you can show your private body parts on the Internet, as Paris Hilton did. But you don't have to worry about working again, nor your children, nor your grandchildren, nor your great-grandchildren. See, to Republicans, there is a noble class. You have to remember that the Republicans date back to the Tories who supported England, to the monarchy, to the idea of landed classes, earls and dukes and nobles. You're born into that class, and if you're born into it, enjoy it. You're lucky. That's your place in life, kings and queens. Great. And if you're not, well, then you need to serve the rich. As Irishman Jonathan Swift once wrote in A Modest Proposal, right? Cook the Irish babies and feed them to the rich English, and everyone's happier. The rich English get a nice delicacy. The poor Irish get some money for their kids. There's not overpopulation. Solves all kinds of problems. That is what they want in America. And if you don't want it, well, that's class warfare, you commie you pinko scum. That's class warfare. So Republicans will never tell you simple statistical facts, such as this one, this very important one. Listen up. I want you to repeat it to all your friends. The top 1% of Americans, the top 1%, 1 in 100 Americans, controls more than 90% of the nation's wealth. I shall repeat. It's a good statistic. 1%. The richest 1% in America control 90% of the nation's wealth. Republicans like to cite income statistics because they're more equitable. They note, you know, that the top 5% control only 50% of the nation's income. But who cares about income when you got wealth? The government taxes income. The only time they tax wealth is when you have an estate tax, when people die. Otherwise, wealth doesn't get taxed, right? If you've got $1 billion in the bank, what gets taxed? Only your interest. You can live on the rest of it, pay no taxes at all. If you have $1 billion in wealth in the bank, you pay zero taxes on the principal, even if you inherited it all. Now, the person who gave you the money, the inheritor, has to pay some tax. But if it's your spouse, I mean, let's say your wife made $1 billion because she's a brilliant whatever, and she leaves it to you, well, there are no taxes a spouse will transfer. You can think of Anna Nicole Smith, right? Bimbo, who with her fake breasts, sorry, but it's true, in her 20s or 30s, sleeping with an 80-something-year-old billionaire, marrying him. And, you know, for all the disgusting acts that she performed, she certainly got paid off handsomely, much better than other prostitutes. Can you tell I have no sympathy for her? And it's not even her I'm attacking. It's the fact that she gets to get all those hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't know how much it was. Tax-free. While another woman is working three jobs, single parent, struggling with her waitress-slash-secretary-slash-part-time grocery store clerk jobs to be barely enough to pay for her child's food. Of course, she can't afford health care. But that goes back to what Phil Graham was saying, right? Stop whining, waitress. Stop whining, secretary. Stop whining, truck driver. You weren't born into luxury. Deal with it. It's not your place in life. Stop whining. Stop complaining. If you were only rich like me, you wouldn't have a problem with this arrangement. And then I think back to, I don't know, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, to some extent, to a much lesser extent, actually, to be fair, the American Revolution, but people revolting against their government saying, now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. As Thomas Jefferson said, all men are created equal. And later, we include women because, you know, 100 years later, 150 years later, we thought, oh, we'll include women too, and black people and people that don't own property. But the sentiments are good, right? All men are created equal. Have you ever thought about the fact that Republican ideology directly contradicts the Declaration of Independence? You ever thought about that? Well, you know what the Republicans will say, because I argue with them all the time. Many of you have heard Republican strategist Mike Lane. I bring him on my TV show. I often share him here on the Horn. And I know that, well, I apologize for all the medical ills that listening to him has caused you. I just want to let you know right now, I'm sorry about that. But there's a reason I do it. And it's not to torture my listeners. The reason I bring Mike Lane on is because I do think it's important every once in a while to hear how the other side thinks. Because they believe this stuff. They really do. I know there are plenty of paid informers for the White House. I'm not talking about Armstrong Williams or Maggie Gallagher or you know, all the people that are handsomely paid to be shills for the administration. Later on, I want to talk about John Yoo. Probably the most classic shill for the administration. He came up in the Ashcroft testimony today in the judiciary. We'll get to him in a second. But I'm talking about ordinary Republicans. People like Mike Lane. People like poor white people. I'm sorry. Many poor white people are Democrats. But a lot of poor white men in America are Republicans, and I don't get it. Some poor white women, too. But, you know, you want the demographic white men. Why are they voting Republican? Well, I mean, let's face it. This is where we get back down to religion, right? This is where we get right back down to religion. Well, Jesus told me to. My minister told me to. Republicans are macho. They got guns. Democrats drink lattes and eat arugula. Republicans eat pork on a stick. I'm sure that's some of it, right? It's a masculine identity thing, isn't it? I mean, let's face it. We have a society that is misogynistic, like most societies. We have a society where men are treated better than women. You know, if you call a girl a man, or she dresses up in men's clothes, or you see her do some terrific sports act or physical activity, she's generally praised. But if a man wants to wear a dress or do a woman's activity, oh, wow, that boy's crazy. Or he's gay. Or he's a sissy or something. I mean, nurses, a wonderful profession, a very important profession, a very necessary, helpful profession. And what, 95% of them are female? I'm making up these statistics, but you get my point. This is all anecdotal. But so let's say 95% are female, and the 5% that are male, 80% of those are gay. So you got 95% female, 4% gay men, 1% straight men in the nursing profession. I bet I'm not too far off. But in the so-called man's professions, lawyers and doctors, and well, women are joining every day, and they should. They're doing very well. There's no reason they shouldn't. But why are women happy to join men's professions? And they should be. I'm glad about that. That's a good thing. But men are so reluctant to join, quote, women's, unquote, professions. What's so shameful about a man being a nurse? What's so shameful about a man being a secretary? Is it that shameful for a man who types fast and takes dictation? I would bet secretaries are 90% women, you know, and 8% gay men and 2% straight men. I just, in my experience with secretaries, it's male identity. It's because men have a problem, and they have a problem because of misogyny. Because in a society where if you call a girl a boy, she shrugs, and if you call a boy a girl, he says, them's fighting words. Men are very, very insecure about their masculinity. And so, yes, I'm coming to the strange conclusion today, and this is a weird philosophical whatever. I'm just playing psychologist today, I guess. But, yes, I think male insecurity creates a lot of Republicans. I don't know what you think about my theory. But when I think about why a poor white guy would vote for a Republican, it's got to be cultural. I mean, you find even, you know, among poor whites, right, women vote more Democratic than men. I don't mean to attack the poor only. I mean, the rich are definitely very Republican, but I understand why rich people are Republican. That at least makes logical sense to me. I don't like it. There are certainly many wonderful limousine liberals. I am not going to attack Ted Kennedy or Franklin Roosevelt, or for that matter, John Kerry, right? I mean, there's no shame to be rich. But I understand why rich people vote Republican. Republicans look out for millionaires' best interests. They do. They do. If you make $100 million a year in a hedge fund, who's going to protect your right to get taxed less than a waitress, less than your secretary? Only the Republicans and a few Democrats that you pay off. Right? So I understand why rich people vote Republican. That's why I'm not going after them. So please don't think but when you get to poor people, when you get to this conundrum, I wonder how much of it is male insecurity and misogyny. I'd be curious to know if you all disagree or if you think I'm wildly off. You know, let me know. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We're going to take a quick break. If you want to call in and talk about this, you're welcome to. When I come back, though, at some point, I'm going to talk about John Ashcroft's testimony today before the Justice Department and the importance of my old classmate, John Yoo, who has made his mark on history, just not a very pleasant one. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I knew under Bush that corporate America was getting off virtually scot-free, but I guess I didn't know the half of it. According to the GAO, the Department of Labor has simply not been doing its job to make sure the most basic things happen, like employers paying employees. In one case, the employer admitted not paying a pool maintenance worker, but then berated the investigator from the Department of Labor, which eventually dropped the complaint. The department kicked another case involving child labor, of all things, with the excuse they couldn't find the employer, though the number was easily discovered through a public records search. Another shady employer dodged the Department of Labor by just not returning phone calls, so they closed that case, too. All told, the number of investigations are down almost 50% from 10 years ago. And check this out. Even when investigators discover wrongdoing, the Bush Department of Labor fines employers only 6% of the time. This is what happens when you have an administration that's hostile not only to workers, but to regulation itself. We've seen the cost of that hostility in our shaky financial institutions, but you don't often see the cost on the shop floor unless you're one of those unlucky workers who calls the government sheriff when there's a crime, and the sheriff just doesn't show up. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm laughing because Bob was telling me that I was a little bit looser today. This isn't sort of my ordinary hard-hitting, fact-based show. You know, Bush did this and John Yoo did this, and I plan to get to that. I really do. I just think I'm a little addled. I've been sick, so, you know, I think of it as not thinking clearly. I guess he likes it. I guess we'll let you all decide which Mark Levine you like better. I do want to get to some of my real Inside Scoop topics, though, because, you know, whenever I see John Yoo in the papers, it's the weirdest feeling. It's very strange. I mean, I know he's evil, but I also know the guy, right? I mean, we were in the same class in law school. I mean, I sat down, I ate dinner with him, we argued. I remember at the time thinking he was a toady. He clearly would do whatever he could to curry favor with every conservative there and the Federal Society and so forth. And he just seemed like a brown noser. I even called him on it. He kind of stopped talking to me for a while. But, you know, it's a small class at Yale. It's like 170 students. You can't really avoid people. But part of it, I got to say, you know what it is? It's all right, I'm going to make an admission here. It's envy. Yes, it's envy. Not to do the things John Yoo did, no, of course not, but to have the kind of impact John Yoo has had. If I could have that kind of impact, if I could have half the impact for good as John Yoo had for evil, I would do a lot of good in this world. And it kills me. Here's a guy who's my age, who had my schooling. I assure you I had better grades than John Yoo. All right? He wasn't a bad student, but he wasn't a great student. All right, I'm bragging. I was a good student. Fine. Done. Bragging over. But, hey, I was a better student than John Yoo. I didn't tell you up to the conservatives. And the liberals just don't have that kind of totally up to us, we respect you kind of way that the conservatives do. The conservatives are, do what we say, follow our orders, and we love you. Liberals, if you follow their orders, they say, what kind of liberal are you? If you agree with a liberal too much, they start looking at you cross-eyed. Well, get away from me. You got to disagree with me about something, or you're not a true liberal. I like that about liberals, actually. But the fascinating thing about Ashcroft's testimony before the Justice Department is Ashcroft is a right-wing conservative. He is. I mean, remember, he is the religious fundamentalist who made everybody pray with him in the morning and covered the naked breasts of some statues of, you know, Roman, you know, representations of liberty or justice or whatever. He covered their breasts because the woman's top half is offensive. He's a right-wing nutcase in many, many, many ways. We all know that. But the astounding thing about the revelations, first coming with his deputy, you know, Jim Comey, where he literally sat up to the Bush administration, despite the fact that he was under enormous pain-killing pressure from his recent gallbladder surgery. The amazing thing about this administration is that a right-wing fundamentalist extremist like John Ashcroft was, wait for it, a moderate in the Bush administration. He was so moderate that he was overruled. And they put in John Yoo. When John Ashcroft is the most liberal member of the administration, you have gone past right wing, fallen off a cliff, and are in a black hole. Pardon my mixed metaphors. But that's exactly what happened here. John Ashcroft proposed five names of people to lead the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel is not usually, or at least not before this administration, not important an organization. I don't want to diss them. I mean, they do set policy for the Justice Department, but it's, you know, there's well-regulated patterns. I mean, the Justice Department is a very important organization. It handles all the prosecutions across the nation, but it's civil servants. It's not political appointees. Yeah, they're political appointees at the top, but most people in the Justice Department are men and women who are prosecutors, who want to put the bad guys away, who want to enforce the law. If anything, they err on the side of being a bit like Dudley Do-Right. But that's okay. I like nerds that want to enforce the law. We need them. That's good. I like prosecutors for the most part, unless they abuse their prosecutorial discretion, but mostly before this administration, mostly they didn't. Mostly they went about and tried to enforce the law in the best way they could. They're honorable people. I don't want to diss most of them until Bush came to office. And the Office of Legal Counsel, which sets these policies that are supposed to be, you know, fairly standard stuff. When do you recuse yourself in a conflict? You know, that you have a policy that you don't indict an electoral group right before an election. A policy they broke, by the way, with Bradley Schlossman in Missouri. But Bush wanted to use it for something else. So when John Ashcroft proposed five perfectly respectable conservative Republican lawyers with great credentials, he rejected all five. All five. And insisted on one, and only one choice. The brown noser par excellence. The toady's toady. The person who would just follow orders all the way to Nuremberg. My old classmate, John Yoo. John Yoo would ask no questions. John Yoo would craft careful legal memos that said that exclusive doesn't mean exclusive. Torture doesn't mean torture. Open means secret. Black means white, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, you say it, John Yoo can draft it. People have talked about, his clever legal arguments. You know, it's not that clever to say black is white. It really isn't. It's not even that hard to do. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act that we've talked so much about, the original one, not the modified one, although even the modified one, both of them, say it's the exclusive way that the president can wiretap Americans, whether they're here or abroad. That's it. It's the exclusive way. The only way. You got to go through the FISA Act. You got to go through the FISA courts. Well, John Yoo came up with the wonderful idea that exclusive does not mean exclusive when in the context of a wartime authority of a president that's been authorized to go to war. Really? Why didn't he find it exclusive? Doesn't mean exclusive when on a day that ends in the word why. Or in both, in only in leap years and non-leap years. Does exclusive not mean exclusive? Maybe exclusive doesn't mean exclusive when the president's name has four letters beginning with a B. That's as logical as exclusive doesn't mean exclusive when awards. Where did he get this stuff? We both attended the same law school. I assure you, he didn't get it from our professors. He made it up. And it turns out that we now know that Ashcroft was fighting him every step of the way. So they made, and Ashcroft is not, you know, my age. Ashcroft was a senator, and right-wing extremist though he be, had some respect, even though, let's face it, he lost to a dead man in an election in Missouri. But Ashcroft refused to appoint John Yoo. I think he knew what was going on. I think he knew that though he be attorney general, he wasn't going to be in charge of justice and law in the United States, not with John Yoo Toady being around. There was a tense standoff, we now know, and they led to a compromise. They put you in, but only if they got a respectable person in, someone Ashcroft wanted, Jack Goldsmith. Defense Department lawyer, certainly a Republican, certainly a conservative Republican, but guess what? One of those rare, strange, unusual, wonderful conservative Republicans that actually believe in obeying the law, that actually respect the Constitution. And you know what? There are some of them out there. And as much as I think they're, you know, wrong for being Republicans, I am glad there are some Republicans that do respect the Constitution, that do respect the law, that do love their country. They exist. Jack Goldsmith is one of them. Jim Comey is another. And it's largely due to Goldsmith that we know what John Yoo was up to. In fact, I wonder what we would know. We might not know for years. We would hear reports of torture. The Bush administration would dismiss it as conspiracy theories. We would hear reports of secret prisons. We would hear reports of sending people to foreign shores to be tortured, of water torture. We would hear all these reports, and they'd all be dismissed as conspiracies. And, well, Karl Rove certainly wouldn't testify about it. And we would never know. So, if I may use a religious term, God bless Jack Goldsmith, an honest Republican. Of course, Ashcroft was before the Judiciary Committee today. Unlike Rove, unlike the current Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, Ashcroft actually did testify under oath. Good for him. The sign of an honest man. And he talked about the fact that John Yoo avoided the chain of command. Why be the chain of command? He was put in by the president himself. Now, I have no doubt that Bush was told to do this by Cheney. Now, I don't know how Bush goes to the bathroom without Cheney holding his hand, but I'm sure that John Yoo was Cheney's choice. But whatever, the president personally overruled Ashcroft, personally installed Yoo, and Yoo knew that he didn't have to go through the hierarchy. In the hierarchy, the top law enforcement officer of the United States is the Attorney General, not even the President. The Attorney General of the United States is the top law enforcement officer of the United States. It's John Ashcroft, but you did not report to Ashcroft. No, he would hold all kinds of secret meetings with his secret war counsel, with David Addington, the lawyer to the Vice President, who is second only to you in the horrible memos he drafted. And let's not forget what you did. I mean, you came up with the classic memo that torture is not torture. Torture is not torture. Torture is not torture unless it leads to death or organ failure. Famous John Yoo memo. Torture is not torture unless it leads to death or organ failure. Bamboo shoots under the fingernails? Well, let's see. No death, no organ failure, not torture. How about the rack? You know where they stretch your bones out? Hold on. Not death. No organ failure, not torture. Pretty cool. How about if they cut your legs and arms off? There are no organs in the legs or arms. I mean, I don't think they're counting skin as an organ, because then a cut would count, so they're not counting that. So they can cut off your legs and your arms. And as long as you don't die, bingo, no organ failure, not torture. Pretty cool, huh? Wouldn't you like to do some of that to John Yoo and say, hey, you know, it's not torture. I mean, I think it's torture, but you said it wasn't, so you shouldn't mind. The irony of all these things, of course, is that Ashcroft was put in a very difficult bind by House Judiciary Chairman John Conyers because he still had to defend a lot of the administration policies. I mean, despite the fact that he would complain behind back doors about John Yoo, he still had to sign off on some of these torture memos. He still had to defend today, and yes, he defended today, waterboarding. While he couldn't say for sure that it led to information, he thought it probably did. And even though water torture was used by the Spanish Inquisitors, even though we executed the Japanese who conducted water torture on our GIs in World War II, even though we court-martialed in the Spanish-American War our own soldiers for conducting water torture, now water torture is A-OK. No, Ashcroft is no liberal. It's only compared to you, John Yoo, that he looks good. And then I think back to John Yoo in law school, and I think, wow, I could have done that. I could have done that, right? I mean, I could have toadied up to the conservatives. I can write a legal opinion that says night is day, the sun is the moon, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. I'd say it right now. I could do that. I could be a factor in world history. I could have brought the nation from being respected all around the world to being known as a bully and as a torturer who hates the rule of law. And then I get all despondent. I'm like, well, why is it so much easier to do evil than to do good? That's what I come up with, right? I mean, I could have done the evil, but I don't know how to do the good. I don't know that liberals who are good law students are rewarded very often, but then I look at someone like Barack Obama and I think, ah, that lucky. I think he is kind of lucky. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. He's very talented, a very talented speaker, all of that. But, all right, I got some envy there, too. Because, you know, at rock bottom, I've never wanted money, but I do want to change the world. And that's when you start hearing the violins, and that's when it gets all syrupy, and that's when, you know, people start making jokes about me attacking windmills like Don Quixote. But, you know, confession, cliche, syrupy confession, yes, I want to make the world a better place. We can all hold hands now and sing Kumbaya. And for all the mocking, that people, generally Republicans, give when I say things like that, that even I almost am embarrassed to say in public, why the heck am I embarrassed to say this in public? What's wrong with trying to make the world a better place? You don't have to be ashamed to say that. That's the kind of world we live in. If you want to make the world a better place, if you don't like the direction we're going, what are you? Say it together with me now. We're all part of a nation of whiners. No wonder John McCain had to distance himself from his top economic advisor. But does anyone doubt that John McCain says these same things in private? Does anyone doubt that? Meanwhile, Ashcroft appeared before the Judiciary Committee. There were some empty chairs. The current Attorney General, Mukasey, refused to appear. He was ordered by the White House not to release Cheney's testimony regarding his possibly treasonous activity. I think it's probably, but okay, we don't have the evidence yet. Possibly treasonous activity regarding outing a CIA agent. Something that George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr., called at one time the most traitorous of acts. What's Cheney trying to hide? I think it's obvious. If he had nothing to hide, he wouldn't have done it. Everyone knows he did this. Everyone from the special prosecutor to Scooter Libby. What do you think Scooter Libby was taking the fall for? If he'd gone to jail, he might well have squealed on Cheney. Well, they couldn't let that happen. So now the Attorney General, the top law enforcement officer of the United States, is refusing to obey a congressional subpoena. Well, there is an answer. It's an answer I've talked about on this show before. The answer is inherent contempt. The inherent right of Congress to take anyone who refuses to obey their subpoenas and lock them up in a Capitol jail cell. And even though I know that that jail cell has been, it's kind of been blocked, it's sort of paved over or whatever, they can lock them up in an office. The sergeant at arms can do that. And what better show of constitutional respect would there be than for the Congress of the United States to hold the top law enforcement officer, the Attorney General, in contempt and to hold him until he speaks? That would truly be protecting our Constitution. And I'll tell you this. House Judiciary Chairman John Conyers has told me he wants to do this. We can do it with Karl Rove, who refused to obey a subpoena, Harriet Myers, and now Michael Mukasey. Let's do it. Please call your member of Congress. Ask them to enforce inherent contempt. This is Mark Levine, signing off.